Mr. Hobson Reel 2.
Then that evening, when I was going dark, we were all heading out of this canyon and marched north. And we marched across the Yellow River, it took me all the time to walk. It was agony. I was dull trying to walk. And as the ground was uneven, every time I jolted my foot, my stomach shook and it really pained. And anyhow, as I say, it was really bad. And as we were walking once we passed the river and we crossed the main supply route, which the Chinese were now using, mule carts, donkeys, these small anti-tank guns on two canoes that we towed down, and there was artillery guns coming down. Or I said, "Bloody glad I'm not in the front line with all this coming down, because they haven't used much artillery up to now." And we were taking off the main supply route because it was too busy, and we had to walk across along the trails and the footpaths in the mountains. We marched all night, half the next day, and during the next morning, as we were marching, what disgusted me was some prisoners of war were volunteering to carry the packs for the Chinese, and yet they were wounded, like such as myself, but they wouldn't help. So now, when we did get to the village where we sorted out and that, all the prisoners were put on the side of the hill. And they had to stay on the side of the hill over daytime. And over night time, they went in caves or tunnels that had been dug like the Chinese to sleep. And they were the same tunnels that the Chinese hid in prior to the attack on the Yellow River, on the Indian River. Now, the wounded, it was about 20 of us, we were all in like a cow shed or something like that, at the side of the house. None of us had medical treatments. The only treatment I had was my field dressing, the Chinese put on. And we got no food. And we were there for so some people was able to get some dried flour and get about a spoonful of it. Or you might get a little bit of a potato with some from the fire and heat and warmed up. But that's the only food. The Chinese didn't have the supplies because was that many prisoners captured, each didn't have the food to give us. Now, after about 10 days or something like that there, we were told we were all moving north to the Yellow River to a prisoner of war camp. And all the badly wounded who couldn't walk had to stay behind. And now, out of the year, about 20 of us, four of us stayed behind. Some were badly wounded, but they pleaded with the mates to take them with them. And they didn't want to be left behind because they thought they would be shot. Anyhow, they all went away, and as soon as they all cleared, we were taken and put in a straw bivouac. And we're sitting there, and we wonder what the devil was going to happen. So we say, "Oh, we think we are going to be shot. That wasn't going to be handled to the North Queens. That's going to be released." They just didn't know. Anyhow, they brought us some food, the first food we'd had off them, which was rice and mule meat, and we joked about with the actions that we get mule meat with the components of the American Air Force, as they would be machine gunning and they'd kill the mule. So anyhow, we had the meal, and I said to the lads, or one of the lads said to me, I can't remember who it was, "Oh, I don't think they're shooting us, because they wouldn't feed us, they want to shoot us." So anyhow, when it got dark, we were all laid away across the fields, and eventually we come to a small road with two trucks there, and there were some more prisoners of war there. And now it turned out there were two trucks, and it turned out there was 12 British wounded and the rest were Chinese. So all the Chinese were on the two trucks, and any room on them at the back we were put on them. So we were told we'd be moving, driving all night, with stops and starts covering the airplanes and that. And then the next day, we'll be rested up. And we'll do that until we get to the prisoner of war camp. And we moved off that night. It was very bad because it was bumpy roads and We didn't help our wounds any. And I was lucky, the Chinese gave the cigarettes, so I helped us a lot. And the next day when we did arrive back, because at the new place, we put up the night, put up for the day. First of all, they showed us where we slept in with straw and that, and he gave us a meal. And then in the evening, they gave us another meal, and we moved on to the trucks. And away we went again. Every time there was an airplane car crossing, which would come off the road and hide in the bushes or under the trees like that. And I forgot to mention that when they were travelling on the roads, they used the headlights. We used to think they were mad. And then when the airplanes come there, you had a rifle shot, the headlights would go out and they would dive into cover. And we found out that when the airplanes were about, we could only see in the valley that they were over. We couldn't see into the valleys. And they had people on top of the hills. And when the planes came near their valley, they were firing a rifle shot. And that would warn them that the airplane was coming to their valley. And then when the airplanes were leaving the valley, they blew whistles. And so, because they had in fine art. And their vehicles also had a big wooden board on the cab right to the front of the vehicle. So as the Americans got flares, it wouldn't reflect on their windscreens, so they could travel along and just ignore them. Anyhow, on the first stop we had with the Chinese, we had one of our members that was moaning all about the food and all that, and we told them not to. Anyhow, the second stop we went at, he was moaning again. After breakfast, he was moaning that he should have had better food. In the evening, he was moaning about better food. So when the time came for us to have our evening meal, we lined us all up and said, "You've been complaining about our treatment. You've been under the lenient treatment policy. We've welcomed you as friends, but you've abused all this. From now on, you don't come under lenient treatment policy. And as punishment, we're handing you over to the North Korean police." And they gave us a small we called a pancake, about 4 inches diameter. I said, "That is food to last you until you get your next meal." So anyhow, these North Korean police came along and took us away with them. And now they marched us all night. And then when they at dawn, he let us rest. So we could eat our pancake. And we had some of our pancake, but it was so heavy, it was too heavy for our stomachs. And then when they went into the building and had their meal. And then we moved up again. We walked most of the day. And then that evening, we were put in the barn. Some local soldiers guarded us while the policemen rested up. And then the next morning at dawn, the police come out again. He gives us a bit of millet in our hands. That was our food. And he marched off again, and that was going on and on for ages until we came out of their area, and then they handed us over to more policemen. And well, that was more or less what was happening for the next 4 months. Anyhow, I won't tell you all that went on because I'll be here for hours and hours and hours. But what happened is, the next couple of days was more or less what I said, and then we arrived at Pyongyang. But then, even the rubble had been bombed, and there was nothing standing, only a few stumps and that. And the next thing, where the devil did we go, you know? And the policeman led us down this path, and we were down this path to the side of the building, and we went into the cellars. And when we got in there, it was really converted into like a university student's accommodation. Anyhow, university students made a fuss of us when they found we were English, but it turned out they were learning the English language. And they were trying to talk to us, but the trouble was, we were learning English of somebody who'd learned English of the Japanese. And by the time they had the Japanese and then the Korean on top of that, they couldn't understand them. So they started writing out what they were trying to say. then we would repeat it in English, and then they would practice it. And for doing this, they gave us bits of food and bits of things to drink, like. So we didn't mind doing it, like. And eventually, we all fell asleep. And the next morning, the Korean students had a little go at us, like, we didn't mind. Give us something to eat, and then a new police came along, and then away we went. And the general idea was the police would take us across the area and pass us over to more police. And the idea, that was the way to take us to a Korean prisoner war camp. But during the course of the 4 months, I think they forgot what they were supposed to be doing to us. Because they stopped feeding us all together. And the only time we got fed was when they were started walking us all around the mountain villages and everywhere, showing us off to the cities, saying that look at the great, you know, soldiers and all that. But it's what they're like now, can't you? And they're trying to humiliate us to the villagers. And the villagers used to shout at us, like in their language, although we couldn't understand it. And they hit us, but he didn't hurt us. I think it was just a gesture. And while they were pretending to hit us, he put something in your hand, which you just ignored. And then when we marched away, we looked in your hand, you found like a tiny bowl of rice with beans in it. And we make sure everybody's got one. And we'd eat it. Without the guards knowing. And sometimes there were marches all day, sometimes day and half the night and vice versa. And then during the course of the marching, when we go along these roads, you used to get the American fighters come across, each before at a time. And if they spot us and they come down to machine guns, and we used to dive off the road into cover. And now, after a while, and we're getting tired, Matt, when the planes would come across, instead of diving for the cover, we used to just drop to the ground, because we need the rest. Our knees used to pain, ankles, hips, everywhere used to pain. In fact, you used to get that hot, or it felt to us that you could fly an egg almost if you could. And so we used to drop, and then when the planes were coming over, sometimes they'd spot you, and you'd realise who you were, and you used to start coming over and waving your wings. So after that, we never used to take cover, because you said, well, they're going to hit us. We can do if we dive for cover, if we're making them know where the enemy is. You said, it's a time hard, they're going to hit us, they're going to hit us. Anyhow, that's what was like marching. Anyhow, we had a few stops. The first stop I can recall was we stopped at this village behind the mountains. And they put us in this room on the corner of a building. They had a single door, which is a typical Korean door, which is very small frames, just like Georgian, only smaller. And they had paper glued on both sides. And they had a window, which is about 6 foot high. But they had no glass, no frame, no nothing, just a square hole. And the kids were all playing outside, bang out we were there. And as it was spring, they were all throwing things at us, which is apples and that. And we started to eat them. So as they were throwing apples, we went, ow, 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 to make them throw more apples. Anyhow, they ran out of apples, well, they got fed up, so they left us. And next, when we looked through the window, they were catching small birds from the nest. And just learning to fly, and they were tying thin string down among the legs, and they'd throw up in the air to fly away. And when you flew at the end of the string, pull them down again. They kept doing this until the birds stopped dead. I thought, the cruel brothers. And they were there, and we got vegetable food off the Koreans. I think the only food we got was off the villagers who sneaked food into us. And then we moved off, and the next big stop I can remember was we went to this other village, this is a good while after, or high up the mountains, and We came up the footpath, and just outside the village, we stopped while the crew went in to find accommodation for us. And while I was sitting there, in the pathway, I picked up a twig. I was just digging in the ground and making a channel past the, you know, tower. And I took some jumps. It was a coin. And when I looked at it, it was a, what they call a spade sovereign. King George the, well, King George the First, something like that, 1700. I said, blimey, I don't mind finding a coin, but all the coins I have to find up in the mountains here. No, English coins are so old, which I still have at home. And anyhow, we eventually moved into the village, and we put in a room, and it was like a long building, but we had this one room with double doors. And it was a courtyard with a big gate out at the end, and the far side had this small building, which turned out to be storerooms for the local village, higher up where we was. Anyhow, we were there for about 3 days and received no food whatsoever from anybody. Oh, and I still have a bio pen that my mother sent me. They only just been in, come on the market. They had very thick refills that was the last few years. So anyhow, we said, we've got to get some food from somewhere. So anyhow, this crew used to come in every day. We used to say, tag a pony in the holy land. I don't know if it was a correct like, word, but he knew what we meant. So anyhow, I asked him, we only opened up one day, we saw some bread there, little lumps of bread all mouldy. So I asked him for, by the way, before that, the American, young American had joined us, a Puerto Rican. He'd been picked up somewhere, he joined our group. And he told us, if anybody asks you who I am, I'm English. They didn't like the Americans. He said, okay. And I was 13 of us now. And I asked him for 13 pieces of bread for this pen. And after about 20 minutes talking to Mbatu, he gave me these 13 lumps of bread for this pen. So we had one each. And now, that was all, that was great. And then the next day, one of the lads, I don't know how come he had them, he had a spare pair of boots. So he saw the same crane, and he managed to get 16 cobs of bread off him for his pair of boots. So he gets all the bread and puts it to one side. He said, come on, cheer out. He said, no, it's mine. He said, oh no, one for all and all for one. He goes, cheer. He said, that's not fair. He said, well, you took George's cob and he got them. Yeah, we shared them. And now, that night, when we were in our room, we heard a knock on the door. So we opened the door, there was nobody there because it was absolutely black. And then after a while, we spotted this basket on the floor. We lifted it in, there was rice in it and cooked fish heads. So we tucked into that. We don't know where it came from, we didn't really ask him. And we put it outside, and we sat there, listening for something to come. But the next thing we know, it's morning. So we opened the door, and there's no basket. Anyhow, that night, we had no food from our people in charge of us. That night, the same thing happened, and we still didn't find out it was. And then the next morning, our crew brought us food, and we had that food. And then a couple of hours later, more Korean police came, and that away we went again, marching over the hills. And then, they've done them all less the same as before, you know, repeat, you know, over hills, going to villages, getting hit, people give us food. Oh, meanwhile, we never had our clothes off. And the only washes we had is where we could grab some water and just, wash your hands and face them and fresh yourself up. I've never had a shave. I think none of us had a shave or a haircut. Well, the last time I haircut, it was about June now. The last time I haircut was in February, and I had every bit of it off. So all my hair was the same length. It looked like a gollywog, I believe. And the beard was long because it'd been a while since I had a beard. The hair was going to the mouth. Used to burn off with cigarettes when we got cigarettes. The next that we had was we were approaching this village in the hills, And as we came out a bend, we showed a big mound of soil with arms and legs sticking out of it. And the next thing you know, we were led into a tunnel that had been dug out of the hill. And we led down this tunnel, which is about 5 foot in diameter. And then we were told to sit down on the floor. And when we got accustomed to the dimness, we could see the tunnel branched into two. The left hand side went to like an office and headquarters of the North Korean police. The other side went down to that big iron doors got there on, you know, like a railed doors, and there was a dim light there. And we were sat there all day. We didn't get any food, we couldn't move, and the Korean police were moving in and out and jeering us as we were passing. And we could hear screams going on down with the bars where the dim light is. And they get a couple of these with action as if it was our turn next light. And now, as the evening came on, we were all led out and lined up by this ditch. And a big pile of Koreans with vehicles all lined up in front of us, and one stood one side, and they were shouting orders, and they shouted one order loud, and he got all the order, and started laughing. Well, no, we thought it was only a verbal noise because we thought they were actually going to shoot us. And then we moved further north again, and we ended up at this place where there was a railway junction. There was one line going north and south and one going east, and it was just a single track. And when we arrived there, we handed over to more police, and they put it in this tunnel that they were digging out and give us picks and shovels and wheelbarrows to dig. Well, we were that exhausted and that weak. There was no way we could dig. We went to the action, but we couldn't do it fast enough. So they put us in this hut because where we were digging out was on a miniature cliff. Although it was well inland, there must have been a drift of the soil at the top. Yeah, it was like a cliff, miniature cliff. And that was the headquarters away from the bombing that they wanted to make them. So they put us in this hut halfway between there and this great rejection. And they said, what water, the only water you could go was near the junction. And if anybody moved or went anywhere other than between those 2 points, they were shooters. So anyhow, we all moved into the hut. We were there for about 6 days or something like that. We never got any food. We didn't see any civilians. During that time, the Americans used to come from the north end, like the cliff end, and fire the railway junctions. The rockets used to go right over the top of our hut. And as it went over, it used to shake like mad dust used to come down. And we all used to huddle on the floor because we couldn't go do anything. Luckily, they didn't hit us. And now, one evening, two Chinese came up to us. And it turned out they were drivers. And they said that the Koreans had told them, the Korean civilians had told them about our flight. And they come across and had a look at us. So he talked to us the best he could, and, spoken English and things like that. And when they found out we hadn't been fed, let's say for 5 or 6 days out there, they couldn't tell you how long, he sent for our Korean guards, and he played havoc with them and shouted them and everything, he couldn't understand them. And anyway, some of the lads had all the shirts stripped. So the Chinese had more than one shirt on. And he took his shirt off and gave them to the lads who had all these ripped shirts. And he gave us cigarettes to smoke and all like that. We smoked ourselves that silly. And after about an hour, they came in with a bowl of rice and fish, and he fed us to it. And he said, they'll give us more tomorrow. So the next morning, as promised, they came and he gave us more rice and fish. And he said, well, they'll be going away, but they'll be back in 2 days' time. And they told our guards they got to feed us. So anyhow, 2 days went by, we got no food. And when they came back in the evening and checked on us, and they found out we had been fed. He sent for our guards, but this time they were threatening them, but they had their revolvers to their heads. Anyhow, the same thing happened. They gave us cigarettes, they fed us, and the next day they fed us again. He said, back in 2 days, and we'll take you with us, because we must get permission from our officer before we can take you. But we'll tell our officer the plight, and he'll tell us to take you. So away we went. After about an hour, our guards came, lined us up in twos, and tied us all together with this electric flex. First of all, by your forearm in twos, and then by your lower arm in line. And he marched us, and he marched us. All that night, all the next day, and all the night after. And the only rest we had is when they stopped for some refreshments or food. And we hadn't got any food, and eventually we arrived at Pyongyang after about 2.5 days. And as we were getting near Pyongyang, some North Korean officer found us, saw us, stopped us, had a word with the guards, told them off. I couldn't stand, but we knew they were getting told off. And we followed him with the guards. He took us to his headquarters, rested us, and after about an hour, he gave us some military cooked minutes. And then he got his soldiers to take us over, and he gave us a bandolier with rice and millet and different things in. Each man had a bandolier, and that was for food for us while he took us to a prisoner of war camp. So they took us away that night, and it took us 2 days or so to get to this prisoner of war camp. But on the way there, the civvies were, instead of using our food, the food we carried, the civvies were giving us food. Eventually, we arrived just near this prisoner of war camp, and we were stopped by this high-ranking political Korean officer who interviewed us and asked us to, instead of going to this other camp, to go within to the peace camp to fight for peace. But we all disagreed. We said, no, we're not going to fight for peace. We just want to go to a prisoner of war camp. So in the camp we go. And when we get in there, there's some South Korean prisoners. So they asked us all our different questions, where we're from and everything. And he said, was you stopped by a Korean officer asking you to go to another camp? He said, yes. He said, why didn't you go? He said, I'm not going there, like. He said, well, you should have done, because you'll die here. He said, you'll be back in a couple of days' time when you change your mind. So we said, well, you're going to die a couple of days' time. How come you're not dead? He said, well, we've been Koreans, they take us out to work on the locals feed us. He said, but you lot, you won't get fed. And it turned out that we didn't have any food off from that night, but the food we carried, they took off us. So we're all bundled into this shed, which is about 20 foot long, or maybe less, about 5 foot wide. It was like a wooden shed, but half of one side was open, like it was like you had horses in. And the one small end was completely open. And we were all packed in there at night time, like sardines in a tin, rather than room to move. And they were stayed all night. The next morning we brought out, and this so-called camp was just a rubbish tip,